You know, I have been watching, or unfortunately I finished watching on Netflix, a series that is called World War II in Color. I don't know, I highly recommend it. And it's fascinating because the introduction explains that one is familiar with these images of World War II, but they're all in black and white. And then they say, you will be amazed to see how the perception changes and gets much closer if you see it in color. So this has been masterfully colored with sophisticated digital methods. And it really changes. Now, I don't presume to be Netflix or, and I don't have sophisticated methods to put this in color, but one of the things that appeared there was a speech by Churchill, I think, well, at some turning point in the war, where he says one of these typical Churchill phrases, which are masterfully crafted. He says, this is not the beginning of the end. It's not either the end of the beginning, it's the beginning of the beginning. So this is classical Churchill. So I am put here in the situation of talking about the beginning of the beginning, but I will not do it in color, I'm not capable, but it's very fascinating to look at this back because it gives a chance to revisit the classics and to see how things evolved in history a bit in a way in which if one were to rewrite it now, one would maybe change the order. And it's not totally unrelated to World War II, because it really all began roughly at that time. So I would like to, if I am capable of making this work, so this is a paper which has one page and a little bit. One column. And this paper is the beginning of the beginning. It's a fantastic paper by a fantastic physicist. This is one of the most marvelous physicists, I think, Stueckelberg. And this is volume, he characterized himself, among many things, for publishing in so-called obscure journals. So this is a paper in Helvetica Physica Acta of 1941. And there are three papers by Stueckelberg in that issue, which really, I think it's fair to say, introduce one of the most fundamental concepts in physics, a concept which has forced upon ourselves once and again. And it's introduced in three lines. Look at this. There is some introduction. This is some electric density, then there is something that you will recognize as well as the Hamiltonian, more or less. And then, look, he says the normalization of psi and its dependence on the quote proper time lambda presents certain difficulties of interpretation of probabilistic interpretation. Certain difficulties. The example just described could explain the following fact. Quote, if I observe at time t greater than zero a particle of mass m and charge minus e, and if I say that at the moment t equals zero there was an electric field, there is a probability WA that the particle has been accelerated Let's see, how do I operate this? Suspense. There. Has been accelerated by the field, and B, a probability 1 minus WA, WB equals 1 minus WA, that the particle did not exist for negative times, but that she was the partner of a pair of particles, m equals to minus e, m equals to c, that was created at the moment t equals 0 by the field. That's all. look at this character. I mean, in this paper, and you see, and the paper and doesn't say anything else, and then there is something that I don't know, something else, and it just follows. So, I mean, that's class. All right. Now, I dipped a bit into this. And this is really not the proceedings, it's some sort of account of topics that were discussed in an ordinary session of the Swiss Academy in the middle of the war. So this guy had guts. In the same volume, then he goes on to explain. Now, how do I do this? Now he goes on more seriously. Well, not more seriously, but it depends. So, all the titles, he says, a remark about air production in relativity theory, and then goes on, and there is this marvelous figure. So, I checked a bit in the literature. I think this is the first paper where this. You are very kind.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I hope this is my last disaster. Okay, there is one paper before this by Fock in 1932, where he does introduce the proper time in connection with the Dirac equation, but it doesn't have this. It's a much more technical paper. So I think it's fair to credit this marvelous idea to Stueckelberg, and of course that's done by Feynman in the abstract of his paper on positron theory, where he says positrons are regarded, parentheses, as by Stueckelberg, as particles traveling back in time. Now, so then maybe I will get rid of, well, there are many things in this paper, it's just marvelous anyway. And how can I? Ah, thank you. Then, you know, paraphrasing this, the title of the short note by Stueckelberg, which was The Significance of Proper Time in Wave Mechanics, I would like for fun maybe to try a title for this talk, which is The Significance of Proper Time in the Quantum Mechanics of the Gravitational Field. This is just to, it's a very pompous title, but it's just to feel blessed by Stuckelberg. Now, although, so the idea, although, as the title, this proposed title explains it, the idea is to talk about gravity, and since this is the beginning of the beginning of the beginning, and is supposed to open more profound and deep and so on discussion, I will be very elementary. So although the problem that we have in mind is a relativistic problem, I would like to start with a non-relativistic particle. It requires a bit of courage to write that phrase on this blackboard, but anyway. So you see, because I think there are things that have to be emphasized. You see, if you go to, so the idea here is twofold. One is to take the path integral as the essence of quantum mechanics. Why? Well, there is one reason why, because there is this strange fact in classical mechanics that there exist action principles, and there exists the action. This is totally foreign to the spirit of classical mechanics that works from an initial value and then goes on forward in time. The action has to do with both ends. And therefore, the existence of the action in classical mechanics is theoretically the most formidable evidence and anticipation of quantum mechanics. So then we are going to take the path integral honestly and just follow it and see where it takes us. So we do this for the non-relativistic particle. One goes then to Feynman, and he says there is a history x of t. This is the first line. And there is t, and there is x, and there is a history. And then one is supposed to sum over either is of x over all histories which have this endpoint fixed and that one fixed. Now, at the very moment of writing x of t, one has made an assumption. The assumption is that t is a good parameter for the word line. So, and without loss of generality, one can say that t has been taken to increase along the word line. You could make it decrease, then you put minus signs and change things by complex conjugates. It doesn't change anything. So once t has been assumed, and that has been assumed, because that's how the problem is formulated. And this is called the kernel rule from 2 to 1, or from 1 to 2. From this, it follows that this character is 0 for t2 less than t1. You know, I want to hyperemphasize that this is not a convenient assumption of any kind. It's implied by the definition. Why is it implied? Because simply, since this is a good parameter, there are no histories in the sum that go back in time. And if there are no histories in the sum that go back in time, the sum is empty, and an empty sum has the value 0. So That's one thing. And so this is extremely important. One finds in textbooks things like, for convenience, we will define the kernel to vanish for negative times, because that simplifies the perturbation expansion. There are lots of time orderings that you don't have to take into account, and then it's of practical help. That's not a coincidence that it simplifies the perturbation expansion or anything. This is an essential part of the definition of the path integral.
That statement is even in Feynman's
work. Yeah, but there was a co-author. And no, because I will tell something with Feynman later on, which he understood this. And then this implies that K is a green function. So if you take the path integral as the definition of what you want to do, and then you proceed to discover quantum mechanics, the basic object is not a wave function. The basic object is a Green function. And this is, it just gives it to you. And well, of course, we know so many other things about the non-relativistic particle that this seems to be excessive elaboration. But when we know, when we go into uncharted territory, the action is the only thing that one has to follow. So it's good practice to know how to follow it here and to be certain that it gives sensible results.
Oh, I blew it.
How is this operated?
It's just
So this was a last minute economy. Right. So then that's now number two. Suppose we are stubborn and we want to be able to include in the sum histories that go back in time. For example, something like this. Still, for the non-relativistic particle, how can we do that? Well, it's easy. We need a parameter that will go forward along the word line, but which is not the coordinate time t, because t is going backwards. So we do this. And this, where now this character is a parameter, is now a good parameter. Not t, because, and the procedure has been known in classical mechanics for ages. This is one. One cost to parametrize the theory, and the price is that so t becomes now a new dynamical coordinate, and the price is that one introduces a constraint, which is the conjugate moment, the canonically conjugate momentum to t plus the Hamiltonian, which is a function of x, p sub x and t. And I will use this Dirac notation, zero. That's done. Then with this, you can have, for the non-relativistic particle histories that go, that do this. Now the action becomes, I will speed up at some point, so don't worry. Minus NH. And then the question is, how do we make this path integral equivalent to the previous one. In this path integral, one integrates over p over x, t, p sub x, p sub t, and n. This Lagrange multiplier that I put here. Now, this problem has a gauge invariance, if you like. It's invariant under rib parametrizations t into f of tau that are the identity at the endpoint. You can check that under, let's say that this is tau plus psi of tau, if it's infinitesimal, you can check that under that the integral of n d tau from t1 to tau2 is gauge invariant. And the reason is that delta n is psi dot. This integral, which is gauge invariant, will be called by an abuse of language in the non-relativistic case the proper time. And then, to compute the integral, well, here you could compute it more easily, but to be in line with what follows, to compute the integral, one may fix a gauge, and there is a simple gauge that doesn't destroy this condition of the identity of the endpoints, which is the gauge in which n is a constant along the trajectory. And this we will call the proper time gauge. All right. Well, that's 1, 2, and this is 3 then. Now, as you know the end of the story. The end of the story is that the initial non-parametrized path integral is recovered if one integrates over positive n. And the reason is that if you do first the integrals, all the other ones except the 1 over n, one gets 2 e to the minus I n h 1, and this has to be integrated over dn. Now there is something very important here that again is elemental in this case, but it's not in the other cases, is that one would like this answer to be independent of this, of the values of the parameter tau at the initial and the final point, because the parameter tau is just an artifact. And if one calculates for this gauge system the Fadejev-Popov determinant, then it comes out to be tau 2 minus tau 1. So this thing for constant n is a proper time elapsed. And then to recover that, one has to integrate from 0 to infinity, which gives 1 over p sub t plus p squared, well, plus, yes, for the free particle, minus I epsilon. So that, so we now know. You see the, there is no notion, additional notion invoked. It's just follow the path integral. And the path integral, if you want to recover the original one, tells you that this is integrated from 0 to infinity. It gives automatically the I epsilon and so on. So after having spent so much, let's see, when do I have to finish, Neil? At, oh, well, I'll try to finish on time anyway. So again, with this business now of World War II in color, then, one now goes to the relativistic particle. And you, I know that all of you know the story, it's just to put what will follow in perspective. Then this p sub t plus p squared over 2m goes over into minus p0 squared plus p squared plus m squared. And then the Green function becomes I should have said here that the reason for the minus I epsilon is to make the integral convergent at the upper endpoint. There is no way to make it convergent at both endpoints. So you could go from minus infinity to zero. That would be a conjugate. That's also fine. Okay, now, just a pause about history. The positron was predicted by Dirac in 1928. It's fascinating to read his articles because he had this talent, unbelievable talent, to get the right answer for the wrong reasons. I mean, the paper on the Dirac equation, for example, is based on the following two assumptions. I remember because I had to give a lecture on the 50 years of the Dirac equation, and I said this, and he was there, but he did not, apparently, he was not listening, I suppose. But so, first, the wave equation had to be a first order in time, because this had to do with some evolution and so on. And second, oh, and he was trying to avoid negative energies, which he didn't. And the second, what was the second? There was another one. Well, there were two. But anyway, so, oh yes, this had to do with fermions because there was the Dirac C, and then a hole in the Dirac C would have opposite charge and so on. Then the thing, of course, worked equally well for bosons, but he didn't care. Now, in 1932, the positron was observed by Anderson. And I don't want to tire you going back to Stueckelberg. You see, 41, less than 10 years after, Stueckelberg says in that paper, in the second paper, that perhaps these world lines going back in time were not taken seriously before because positrons had not been observed, which is so it would have been, of course, interesting to have Stueckelberg writing his paper in 1930. That would have been fun. And he would have avoided a lot of effort. Okay, so now I will come back to this phrase at the end of the talk, but in this short article of Stueckelberg, he says there is a problem of probabilistic interpretation because the particle maybe did not exist before and it's just the partner of an opposite particle and so on. And then Stueckelberg also mentions that if one takes the quantum theory of a charged field, then that, he says, is a very different story. It's fun to read the paragraph. It's a very different story because none of this happens. And the reason that none of this happens is that for a quantized field, the analog of the constraint H is now something that depends on the spatial point. And is, I will write it only schematically, is p sub t of x plus p of x, where this is the energy density, which for a good field is positive. All right. So if you quantize a field, then this is analogous to the non-relativistic particle. And therefore, the k of 2-1 for the field, which is a functional, it's 0 for t2 less than t1. So there is this fascinating interplay. You know, this phrase of Stueckelberg that there is some kind of a difficulty with the interpretation in terms of probability for the quantized particle does not arise for the field. And there is a very strange thing, which is that, you see, this minus I epsilon, if you do perturbation theory and do Feynman rules and so on, it's there. Well, it's there because of this, but it does the job of ensuring that the theory is unitary. If you don't put the I epsilon, the theory is not unitary, and Stueckelberg is sunk, because that is a problem of interpretation. But if you put the I epsilon in the perturbation series, then the theory is unitary. Of course, Feynman and Wheeler at the beginning did not put the I epsilon in the direct particle theory, and just look, well, it depends how you define it, the imaginary part of this K, but that they failed because, and there is a footnote in Feynman. So if you work in terms of Feynman rules and put this minus I epsilon, which allows the particle histories to go back in time, then I epsilon ensures unitarity. In proper time. So unitarity in proper time means, of course, that this picture of Zuckerberg's, that if the electron goes back in time, then this is the same as electron positron annihilation and so on. But you don't say electron positron annihilation because there are no positrons. This is just an electron going back in time. And the unitary, I mean, it's very, I have a phrase for, well, and.
Do you mean causality rather than unitarity?
Well, I think they are both equivalent, and that's one of the great things, that causality, well understood, as Feynman understood it, is equivalent to unitary, to unitarity. But technically speaking, if you were not worried about causality, if you want something so that the probabilities add up to one and so on, technically, this does the job.
I think unitarity also requires hermeticity of the Hamiltonian.
For the field. For the field. Yes. But if, well, it, that's there. So I just want to say that, let's see, how did I write it here? So if you like, I will put causality in proper time. No, it says causality in proper time. And which is forward and backward. In coordinate time. And I will put physical time. And so these Feynman rules and so on. And then physical time unitarity only forward in T for the field does the same. So you see, for the field, the outcome of the path integral is retarded in physical time. For the particles, it's retarded in proper time. And the fact that these two are equivalent, it's a very magical thing. I have a phrase from Bjorken and Drell, a footnote. He says, so he starts with Feynman rules in volume one, and then he says, these rules find their justification in the systematic but painful formal exposition of quantum field theory given in volume two. So, really, the equivalence of these two things, it's not obvious. at all, because the matrix elements are all crossed. I mean, and you have to reorder them. And the fact that these two different notions of unitarity exist is a very magical thing, and I will reserve a phrase of Feynman's for that miracle for the end. Maybe I will just add one picture, but I would not like to start a discussion now. If you draw for a particle this, the arrow means that the proper time is increasing, then, and this, let's call the line gamma, this line, this history. Then the pair 2-1 is a boundary, is the boundary of gamma. And it's an oriented boundary, because gamma is also oriented.
Wait a minute, what's gamma? I missed.
The curve.
Oh, the curve. Thank you.
I just wanted to be fancy. I wanted to put this. All right, now this is a clandestine provocation for the rest of the discussion, because the path integral gives a green function, which is a good thing, and B, only positive lapses are allowed. But I'll stop there, and then I'll hide it. Okay, then I would like to go now to the gravitational field. And it's of course embarrassing to write the equations, but if this is going to be relatively self-contained, then the analog of x mu for the particle is the metric of a space-like surface. The analog of minus p0 squared plus p squared plus m squared is 8 equals to gij kl pi ij pi kl, where this pi is the conjugate of g, and then there is minus g times the scalar curvature of the metric, and then plus g lambda, maybe 2, where that's a cosmological constant. Now, this is a technical remark, but it's not a trivial technical remark. This character is The technical remark is the following. This is not the age which is used normally. It differs from the age which is used normally by a power of square root of g. This is a density of weight 2. Now, that is a seeming technicality, has really important consequences, because it makes the path integral much more tractable, and it does other good things, which I will mention in a moment. You know,
GPP is positive definite form, right?
No.
No?
No, that's the whole point. It has one negative. That's the rest of the talk.
G capital has one negative.
Yeah, this comes next. This guy.
Well, yeah, it's a scale factor.
Yes, it's not what they would say.
I hope this is subtracted from my time. No. Yeah, that's the whole point. All right, so as usual, he gets ahead of me. And then there is this additional thing which doesn't happen for the particle. There is some character called HI, which is the generator of special changes of coordinates, which is, this is 0, and this is 0. Okay. Now, okay, let's go to Slava's point then. One may define, so I will do the following. To imitate the point particle, I will separate this H into H0 plus GR, where H0, I'm sunk now. Uh-oh. Yes, I apologize. I should have started with the other blackboard, but anyway. So H0 then will be this object and then H is H0 plus GR. Now, to go to Slava's point, one may change the variables and write Gij equals to G to the 1/3 times gamma ij, where the determinant of gamma ij is 1. And for algebraic reasons, one defines a variable t with splendid square root of 6 times the log of g to the 1/3. I think this was done by Dirac already in some paper. Then this h0 becomes, oh, well, I should really explain something. First of all, this h0, and hi stays the same. This h0 and hi obey a closed algebra, just as the original complete h and hi obey an algebra, a closed algebra. The algebra of h0 is much simpler because since the spatial points are decoupled, there are no derivatives. All the derivatives are here. Then h0 of x with h0 of x prime is 0, unlike the complete h, which gets an hi here. So this theory by itself that will be could be taken as the analog of the free particle. It's consistent. So H0 becomes minus PT squared plus somebody which is called gamma ijkl. With the other guys, I mean, with pi tilde, where the pi tildes are the conjugates, all this can be done. Now, there is something that's very pretty here, that the space that has this gamma, which is a function of the little gammas, this space is a five-dimensional space at each point x, and this five-dimensional space turns out to be something that is called a symmetric space. This metric, this supermetric in this five-dimensional space is invariant under changes of gamma ij, which are of determinant 1. And so one may define precisely this object as I'm trying to get the sign right. I'll fix the sign in a moment. The sign is always a nightmare, but it has to come so that let's see. This guy is the I in DDT. I have to look up.
Mario, just the pi twiddles are usual momenta divided or something by gamma? What is pi twiddle?
Well, I'm trying to not to say, because the...
In the line above, where it says h0...
No, I understand, but... yes, if you want to do it like that, it's a bit of a nightmare, because they are not all independent, and there will be a trace taken out, and there is some machinery, so...
It will be explained right now.
No, but that can be done, but I just want to jump to this, because the idea is that... pi t will then go to 1 over I dA dt, I can put the partial derivative because all the points in x are decoupled. And then this gamma pi tilde will go, if I fix the sign properly, to be the Laplacian in this five-dimensional space. And so if I do that, then the thing will be d2 over dt2. Plus, presumably. And then plus, no, then minus, because, right. So the idea is then that this, with a minus, this whole thing is positive. So that's, I always, that is this, but with an overall minus sign.
And Laplacian is functional derivatives, right?
No, because all, because this H0 has no special derivatives. So we will, you see, the final, I mean, the.
This is something, isn't G a function of X and gamma a function of X? Well, this is some model.
No. That's a, it's not a model. You see the. Yes, that's the points decoupled because the spatial derivatives have been omitted because this thing was omitted. So the points decouple, so the functional derivatives will all have a delta in front, a delta function. So the idea is that the, if one calculates the, let's call it the free propagator for this, it will be a product over all points x of things at one point. Is that clear?
So I assume pi tilde is traceless, correct? Pi tilde is a symmetric, and traceless.
Yes.
Correct. Yeah. And then is the p sub big t, is that the trace part?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I have it somewhere.
Good.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Yeah, I should go more carefully. Yes, so this thing is the trace. Okay, I am sorry I went ahead too fast. In terms of the, so the free propagator, I am, will be a product over x of things at one point. That's what Jim was asking. Now, I would like to emphasize that I am proceeding here as if, which is probably the truth, as if I did not know anything else but the action. So just follow the procedure and see what happens. So the idea then is that just to mimic Feynman rules in principle, one would like to have the analog of a free propagator, which would be the basis for the perturbation theory. The perturbation theory will have this guy as the quote potential, in which the particle, which is the spatial section of the universe, moves. And when the potential is turned off, it will move according to H0. And we would like to implement the procedure by imitation, because we have no other criteria. That was implemented for the non-relativistic and relativistic particles. So we want to implement the proper time gauge, and we simply copy. We will put n dot equals zero, which is the Lagrange multiplier that would go in the action in front of h. And we will put the shift equal to zero, so one has two surfaces and this is the point x, and that's the point x in the next one. And this distance is proportional to this, really, with the n being used here, is n g to the minus a half delta tau, because this n, no, n probably plus, because this n had weight minus one. So this n is not the usual n perp. If I call n perp the lapse, then probably this is n times g to the minus a half. Now, these are technicalities, but are important. With that choice of weight, this metric big gamma in the five-dimensional space has a nice properties. It's geodesically complete, and all sorts of good things that will not be present if we had used the standard convention with g to the minus half inserted somewhere. And it also simplifies the analysis of the ghosts in the path integral enormously. So there appears to be some solid reason why this is preferred. You see, let me just point out that this should be obvious in a sense, because suppose you had the old bosonic string. You have this Virasoro generator, which is p mu plus dx mu d sigma squared. You see, this is really G11 on the string. And this is again of weight 2, and there is no factor here. If one were crazy, one would, and were in love with densities for some reason, one could divide this by square root of G11, and it would get some awful thing. So don't. So this is just the analog of that. It's very natural. I am almost done. So the next step in this is the following. One would like to calculate the plus is because h zero has a minus the Hamiltonian.
So Claudio, you don't want to put any methods besides of cosmological constant?
Not for this, no. One could, I mean, because all that is, no, because a cosmological constant, again, that's a very good point. You see the cosmological constant is the analog of m squared. It's sort of in there to begin with. And the matter would go with this character. Well, so again, if one integrates only over proper times, which are positive, one gets this as a result, just as before. And then one would like to calculate it. And then there are two things to remark. First, so one does Fourier analysis. So one would like to do things in terms of an analog of a plane wave. It so happens that, so first of all, Fourier transform in time. So then the analog of p squared plus m squared is, and then I will get the sign probably wrong. All right, so that's H0, the time part, and this 5 is in the 5-dimensional space. So the Fourier transform in time.
In the exponent, I think you want T, not tau. It's root 3
over 2t. Thank you. So, first of all, one expands the Fourier transform in time. It's a Fourier transform. I mean, it's an expansion in terms of eigenfunctions psi omega of this whole thing. Not just of this, part of the whole thing. Now, these things, amazingly enough, can be identified. And this is a Hankel function with argument I omega over square root of lambda or something like this, of e to the whatever, to the 3/2 t or some constant times t. And that is conceptually important in a moment. So. So this is the Hankel function, which, well, is the second. What is the name? There are these names. It's something of the second kind. It's some kind of. It's a modified Bessel function, which tends to zero for large values of the argument. That's when the index is real. When square root of lambda goes to zero, this thing tends to I omega t. And then there is some beautiful analysis of how one does a Fourier transform on a symmetric space. There is a book by Helgason on that. The analog of a plane wave has its five. It has five arguments as the analog of the spatial momentum p. There are two arguments which are the analog of the wave number k, and three arguments which are Euler angles, which is the propagation direction of the wave within the five-dimensional space. The only thing that matters here is that the eigenvalues of delta go so delta phi omega is minus omega squared of lambda, where these are the equals to, these are what I called wave numbers. I only write it so that you believe that this has some content, it's not hand waving. So there is a formula for the Laplacian acting on omega that for a relativistic particle would give p squared plus m squared or something, or p squared, and p squared plus m squared, because this is, anyway. So this is the analog of omega squared equals to k squared. Then,
second solution, which is zero, why you exclude it? Because of I epsilon prescription or what? Because there is other solution besides of this Hankel function.
No, the just as for the plane wave, both will be included. Positive omega and negative omega. And yes, they will be incorporated by means of the I epsilon in the right way.
But if you usually quantize the scalar field, you have to make a choice of positive frequencies. Otherwise, you don't get a positive definite inner product on the Hilbert space. That's the whole Dirac C or whatever you're talking about.
Yes, but
how does that come in here?
No, but the point here, absolutely, the point here is that what is being done is not the analog of a quantum field theory. It's the analog of the quantum theory of a relativistic particle in one dimension.
Oh, I understand, but you have to build in the end an inner product, I suppose.
Yes, and
if you probabilities.
Absolutely, and the inner product, maybe I can go back to that.
Sure.
Just after I finish this. Or maybe I do it now. This, I think, was also done already by Stuckelberg. You see, suppose you have the Klein-Gordon equation. All right. And then you replace this by I defy the tau, and then you have a plane waves with energy, tau. Okay, so you can have a is such that don't something like so you have eigenfunctions of this thing in lambda. Then you can have an inner product, which is the integral of phi star of x lambda, phi star phi of x lambda, d4x. This is what Stuckelberg was talking about. Now, if you put a lambda here and a lambda prime here, then this will go as delta of lambda minus lambda prime times, let's call this phi. This will have a form like this with a delta of lambda, lambda prime outside. Now the question is, who is this character? Well, it has to be positive definite, because this was positive definite to begin with. And if you work it out for the free Trangordon equation, it turns out that this is just the Klein-Gordon, I mean, the integral of the of J0, the Klein-Gordon current, but with the minus sign in front of the negative frequencies changed into a plus sign.
Claudio, this is known as the induced inner product.
Fine.
I agree completely with what you're saying. It's much neglected in studies that really do good equations.
Yeah, so you agreed then?
I don't completely agree with this.
So we call this the Halliwell inner product.
Okay.
After
Stuckelberg.
Because it was invented by Stuckelberg.
Well, it has other weird names like Refill.
Like, really?
Refill.
Refill.
R-I-E-F-F-E-L.
Somebody in mathematics must
have said that.
From the 70s. Oh, well.
But I agree with calling it the Halliwell product.
Okay. I think it was in Stuckelberg. Stuckelberg Halliwell. Okay. All right. I don't know if that answers it. Not too much.
No, I think it's probably also related to this. Is it related to Sorkin? Sorkin?
Oh, well, Halliwell Sorkin then. You just change the sign in front of the negative frequency. All right. So the induced inner product. Okay. No, but this is what he had in mind, because if you read back this paper of Stuckelberg's, it says in parentheses, normalized to one. So he has already removed this thing. There is also a wonderful paper by Nambu in the 50s, which is called The Use of Proper Time in Quantum Electrodynamics. I think he also has this. Okay. All right, I'm running over time now. Okay, so the answer to Slava then is that, yes, both signs are included. Okay, then disappeared. So then there is, in momentum space, there is a formula for k of 2-1, which is delta of omega 2 minus omega 1 times 1 minus omega, say, 1 squared plus omega squared of lambda plus lambda minus. Probably that's it. Right, and there is something nice that this thing can be thought of as adding an imaginary part positive. Imaginary part to the cosmological constant. So that's a nice prescription. In for Feynman rules, you add a negative, a minus I epsilon to the mass. Here you add nicely a minus I epsilon to a cosmological constant. That's equivalent to integrating over positive proper times. And to get back the propagator in the space of the GIJs, one has to do the inverse Fourier transform in this symmetric space, which is pretty, but it's a bit of a nightmare, and I will not even attempt to write it. It's done in some paper. I can give you the reference. So the reason I did this is to inject some concreteness in the analogy of the gravitational field with the relativistic particle. And to come back to this thing of the, I will omit some other remarks because I'm over time, but that's fine. To this thing of World War II in color, look at what has happened. It's a bit ironic. For the relativistic point particle, if you read the papers of Feynman, or if one were to talk to him, the title of the paper on quantum electrodynamics is Space-Time Approach to Quantum Electrodynamics. And of course, the philosophical reason, and this has been elaborated upon a lot, is that the view was that space-time is there and things don't happen, they're just there. And so that's the word space-time. I mean, rather than them happening in a sequence in time. Now, I think that the paper really should have been called Proper Time Approach to Quantum Electrodynamics. And the reason is the following. Although at that time he seemed to emphasize space-time as the main thing inside which these trajectories were moving, were drawn, not moving, then there was this problem of Stuckelberg of reinterpreting the trajectories that would go back in coordinate time as in terms of paired annihilation or creation of things that only moved forward in time. The reinterpretation, which is of course backward in time, I mean, the interpretation itself, was called quantum field theory. If you now see how the progress has been, I mean, the next object, and I will venture into things in which I'm no expert, but the next object that was propagating within space-time was at the beginning the Nambua string. Then it turned out that in those old days, one needed 26 dimensions then. So in that sense, this X mu's, which were the space in which things happen and where we're supposed to, I have been avoiding the use of a sinister word, which is the word observer, because it's very dangerous. It now turned out to be not the space-time one had in mind, which was four-dimensional old space-time, then it had this extra coordinates. So it wasn't by itself space-time. But now if you keep pushing it, one goes to a gravitational field, which in a sense is the ultimate expression of relativity. After all, you see, we went from a non-relativistic particle to a relativistic particle. Well, if you like, you can put the string in the line, and then the gravitational field. And in the case of the gravitational field, if you take the original point of view, which is just the action, what would be the analog of space-time if one had wanted to put as a title of the paper, blah, 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 approach to quantum gravity? Well, Wheeler, of course, wrote it. He said superspace is the arena for quantum gravity, he said. The point is that that's fine. But it would be a bit crazy to try to invent a quantum field theory of fields defined on superspace with the requirement that they should propagate only forward in this time t. Because we're not going to be sitting there looking at that time t. And so it would appear that, quite ironically, but it would appear that if one takes relativity from special to general relativity and so on, the theory is ready and one should keep the original interpretation that it suggests, which is really things going back in time. And of course, in gravity, things go back in time already classically, because for elliptic space, I mean, these things contract and then expand. So there is no need to reinterpret anything. I mean, it's just given that there is, in principle, no problem of causality. The marvelous thing is that general relativity solves by itself this problem by simply making it irrelevant. You know, I once discussed this with Feynman many years ago, this problem. And he said, this business of time ordering is an illusion. There is a conspiracy. All the relativistic quantum mechanics is arranged so as to make you believe that things don't go back in time, but they do. And I think that that's right. And so in quantum gravity, I think there is A, no conspiracy, and B, no need for the conspiracy. So that's it.
Well, I have wrote down four questions which I think could be answered in the context of the parameterized non-relativistic theory. The first is the proper time a measurable quantity? The second question is, does the notion of causality in proper time translate into the ordinary notion of causality that we drank up the coffee here and that's why the cup is empty? The third question is, does the proper time become the usual time in some classical limit? And the fourth question is, what about spin? Feynman, in his 49 paper, of course, derived the rules of electrodynamics by considering histories of gamma matrices that depended on proper time.
Okay.
Okay.
More?
Should I repeat them? No, that's it. I said there were four.
The first time was
The first question was, is proper time measurable somehow independent of...
Let's leave that for the end.
Paper?
Let's answer that at the very end, or not answer it. So let's go to the second one first.
Okay. The second one is the notion of causality in proper time coincide with the usual notion of causality.
Yes, that's that.
Okay.
So the answer to the second one is yes.
All right. So you're pointing to that property.
I'm pointing to...
yes.
I mean,
and is there some plastic?
In the classical data, for the non-relativistic article, it becomes the Fourier time.
Okay.
In for the relativistic particle, it becomes the proper
time. And finally, what about spin?
Oh, spin. Well, I suppose it can be done in different ways. In this way, the one way in which it can be done is the following. So for spin, one, I suppose there are other ways to do it, but one way is that one needs a classical description to do it in this way. Of spin. So let's put between me and the quotation marks. And so one way to do it is the following. There is a wave function, and then one introduces, well, not wave function because it's classical, introduce five anti-commuting C numbers, as Schwinger would call them, or really a Grassmann. So, I mean, this has been done by several people. So then they are called theta mu and theta 5, which will secretly be gamma 5, gamma mu, and gamma 5. Secretly, because this will be their representation as operators following from some classical Poisson bracket. And so these guys obey some symmetric Poisson bracket. Roughly something like this. And this is symmetric, it's the classical analog of an anti-commutator. Then there are these things. And there is a new thing called S, which is theta mu p mu plus theta 5 m, which is a technical way of implementing the fact that S is H, so that the Dirac equation is the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation. Then, if one cranks it in the integral for the propagator, there is an integral over this, over the proper time that we were talking about. And there is another integral over an anti-commuting analog of it, which is the anti-commuting partner of the proper time. And that gives correctly the propagator for the Dirac equation. Now, the interesting thing is that there is no analog of integrating over positive anti-commuting times. It's just everything is taken care of by the usual one. So that's it. Now, these are two questions. I answered two of the four. No, the first one is that. No, the first one was whether the proper time is observable. I destroyed it. Observable. And that, of course, that's a million dollar question. I don't know, but if you look at the formulas, all the things that one wants to calculate in terms of the Halliwell inner product. And this includes really, I mean, this delta of zero here, it's an integral over all proper times. And there is, and the proper time is always integrated. So I would suppose that that means that one, at the end, for physically relevant things, sums over all proper times. That's what the formalism is telling you. So maybe that means that it's not observable, but those waters are too deep for me. There are two conflicting schools of thought that you are very familiar with. John Wheeler was saying, never calculate before knowing the answer. And the other is David Gross, calculate. So,